This is a segment from the Annex Sociology Podcast. For more information, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
So, I have a banter item, which is not mutually exclusive with me not having a second. and this first banter item is that Washington University St. Louis, which is best known to sociologists as the home of the tea room trade and then a fist fight between a graduate student and a professor, which over an insult written in ancient Greek, which got the department shut down. And then it came back with the sociology department about 5 years ago after like a 30-40 year hiatus. Anyway, so Washington University St. Louis, they just announced a new policy that they are going to bill researchers for IRB, which, right. You know, I remarked on Twitter is kind of like in a totalitarian regime when they shoot you in their underground prison and then send the bill for the bullet to your family. This is kind of an interesting thing to think about, right? Of that you have IRB is, you know, not only creating hassle for you, but is charging you for the service. One way to view it is that however reluctant you might be to do IRB, it is a necessary service just in terms that you won't get, federal grants without running them through IRB. The other way to think about that is that that's what the indirects are for, is that, you know, the university, and I checked, WUSTL does this, they have high indirects. So it's not like they charge you 10% indirects, but then they nickel and dime you. It's like, no, they do both. It's like paying $20 for the movie theater ticket and $20 for the popcorn. It's not like right. The movie ticket's $5 and then $20 for the popcorn. So they have high indirects and they're nickel and diming you for this. But, you know, another way to think about it is that this is the kind of thing that might make sense or at least might not be too bad for some of the hard sciences where you do see basically everybody works on grants and just makes no sense whatsoever when you apply it to the social sciences where the grants tend to be a lot smaller and a large proportion of the research is done without grants at all because basically you just need your computer and some time. And I was thinking that, you know, one effect of this is like, imagine if you're the search committee for WUSTL sociology, or for that matter, another WUSTL social science, but sociology is the one that's in the growth phase. Imagine trying to recruit, say, one of us to come work there and say like, oh, and by the way, you know, you're going to have to pay $2,500, you know, for your initial IRB review and then $500 for continuing review.
Gabe, I wasn't clear about the pay structure. Now, is everybody getting a $2,500 charge, or are there exemptions for, you know, startup projects or sort of early stage research?
I wasn't sure about that either. Let's say for the sake of argument that there are exemptions. This kind of cheapskate policy of trying to charge people for this sort of thing, even if you have exemptions, still creates the perception. Which is, you know, and also even if there are exemptions, there's still hassle involved in getting an exemption. But as far as I know, there aren't any exemptions. It's just $2,500, period. And then maybe they'll do like a, you know, they'll create like a micro grant to pay for it. But, you know, at that point, you're just adding transaction costs and pure dead weight loss.
So I have a question. What is what rationale do they put forth as to why they have this in the works? I mean, is it just because they're trying to encourage as many faculty as possible to apply for grants, which, you know, if their university works anything like my university, that actually might increase the cost of doing business?
Sure. I didn't see a rationale put forward. I would bet that some administrator had the idea that all units on campus should be self-supporting. And that if something, and, you know, in the same way that, you know, a department might pay, you know, IT, you know, a certain fee per faculty member for tech support, you know, which doesn't strike most people as unreasonable. They might feel like if IRB is providing a service, which, you know, in some twisted sense it is, that people should be paying for that service. But, you know, to me, that strikes me as penny wise, pound foolish, because you're going to piss off faculty And you're going to make it much harder to recruit new faculty, especially in those fields where grants aren't as common.
Yeah, I was guessing it might even be the opposite. And you have to go with me here, but there might be some kind of Laffer curve on like how much overhead people are willing to pay before not even applying for grants anymore, where they just give up on the system. So they, you know, if they're taking 50% of the grants just on overhead, and then they nickel and dime to not get above that 50% mark. And you also have the external factor of grant funders capping overhead. Right. So this could be a way that they're trying to get around the system.
But the indirects are the same as they are at UCLA. It's 50% indirects, just like it is at UCLA. Yeah. And UCLA doesn't nickel and dime you for IRB.
Yeah. But, you know, so if they want to pass that 50% threshold, then do you start nickel and diming? So still on paper, the overhead is 50%.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. It could be like some municipality that, you know, by statute isn't allowed to raise property taxes, but they have pension liabilities because they let cops retire at 30. And so they're trying to figure out how do we increase our tax base. And so they say, oh, we're going to install a red light camera.
You know? Yeah, I was thinking of IRB as like the Waldo, Florida, right? It's like the Waldo, Florida of the institution, right? Which is that town that has like six people in it, but mm-hmm. makes millions of dollars a year.
Mm-hmm. But what is that? What is that? How does that work?
Oh, it's, I think they were... They got caught doing, Waldo, Florida is this town that it's this like minuscule small town, but it's the town exists basically as a speed trap, right? So, you know, they make millions of dollars of revenue by, you know, having people go from 5 miles an hour to 10 miles an hour to 40 miles an hour and then pulling people over and arresting them, right? So it's basically the IRB becomes this like profit generating source for the institution beyond the overhead.
But what about the fact that serving on an IRB board is also a service obligation that takes time? And the idea that maybe we should be pricing in service time to the cost of doing business.
Well, first of all, I don't know if there's any indication whatsoever that this is going to be used to buy course releases or summer nights or whatever for faculty who serve on the IRB board. I highly doubt that that's the case.
I'd be surprised. Yeah.
But, and second of all, you know, this brings me back to what I was ranting about a couple of weeks ago, which is how about we just don't do this, right? How about rather than saying like, oh, well, we should compensate people for doing service, it's like, how come we just don't make less service? And in the case of IRB, the irony of this is that this comes about a year after the federal government changed the Common Rule to basically say you can abolish social science IRB. I mean, not entirely, but, you know, the Common Rule reform that was led by Suzanne Fiske of Princeton University basically said that, you know, 80% of what's currently covered by social science IRB can just be exempt, and exempt would really mean exempt, not expedited, which is in practice what exempt means now. So if university IRBs were to actually implement that, they would radically cut down on social science IRB, maybe cut it 2/3 of it off. And those are precisely the people who have less grants. And so it would actually be, you know, and thus for whom it's a significant barrier. I mean, imagine the perspective of a grad student who's making a $12,000 stipend. And, you know, this is 10% of their annual income. No, more than that, 20% of their annual income to file for IRB so that they can do their dissertation. I mean, it wouldn't be 20% of their annual income every year, but it would be 20% in the year when they file their prospectus. And let's say that they did two different projects, you know, or that, you know, they had like a psychology student where they have multiple projects because, you know, psychology articles, you typically have study one, study two, study three. And some IRBs like you to treat those as separate studies rather than amendments to the first study. So,
well, you know, I don't know. You know what this actually brings up for me is, you know, there are a bunch of institutions out there who either are research one or say they're research one or have aspirations to be R1 institutions. And, you know, and so what do they do in order to become or maintain their R1 status? Rather than ensuring that their faculty are given the resources in order to do research, they basically just tell them, we're just going to make greater demands on you and you figure it out. I mean, that seems like the most ridiculous thing in the world. If you want people to actually be research productive, then you need to give them the supports that they need in order to be research productive. You know, otherwise, I guess you just hire people who already have a very long CV and just tell them, just show up and teach. I mean, I just don't get it.
And I think even for, you know, like privileged people who, you know, are doing grant fundable work and have grants, even in my own work, I can see how this would, you know, if University of Toronto did what WashU was doing, it would decrease my ability to launch pilot projects and to just experiment. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, right now I have a grant, and part of that grant is I'm just, you know, pre-testing a lot of stuff on MTurk and playing around with ideas. And I have to fill out an IRB for each one of those. If I had to pay $2,500 to test each stupid idea I have on MTurk, I wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, well, that actually is a good point, in that it gets to what some legal scholars or law and economics scholars call permissionless innovation. That whenever you put, even if the fees are low, right? The real problem with IRB, so for me, as somebody who has a research budget and all that sort of thing, the real barrier is not the $2,500. I mean, I don't like it, but it's not that big a deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I had to choose between paying $2,500 and IRB would go away, like just a pure extortion racket, and like basically if I had to choose between the paperwork and the $2,500, I'd choose the $2,500. But, you know, I might feel differently if I was a penniless grad student. But, you know, the sheer fact of having to ask, basically, whenever you put a hurdle in front of something, you make it harder to innovate. And, you know, you see some more issues with things like royalty licensing for including music in a TV show or a documentary. It just the sheer fact of having to get legal clearance can be very difficult. I remember when I was writing my book, it took me days and days to get clearance to use certain photographs in my book, even though they were clearly for fair use because it was for purpose of commentary. But you know, the publisher, reasonably enough, was risk averse and wanted me to get clearance. And so I had to spend all this time tracking down who owned the photos and negotiating with that sort of thing. That adds time and hassle. And so you end up doing less of it. And so I figured in my next book, I'm just not going to use photos unless I absolutely have to. And similar thing with Clayton's idea about IRB. Yeah.
But Gabriel, isn't it the case, though, that, I mean, it's not like the scenario where you're like, okay, I'll give you $2,500 and you'll leave me alone. It's, I have to give you $2,500 and you also won't leave me alone.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. I'm saying it's the worst of both worlds. I was just saying, hypothetically, if I had to choose the money or the hassle, I'd choose to get rid of the hassle and pay the money. But they both create barriers. And you know, again, this is as a faculty member who has a research budget. If I was a grad student, the hassle would still be a barrier, but the money might be an insurmountable barrier. And I feel like this is a general problem with IRB, in that it's written for the med schools. And it makes a certain amount of, you know, so if you have some medical lab that's developing drugs and has a big contract with, you know, Pfizer or whomever, or, you know, a massive NIH grant, $2,500 is nothing. You could just write it in, and this is probably what they're keeping in mind. But they're forgetting that, you know, social, because they probably, you know, if it turns out that WUSTL has implemented the new common rule, that's great. But you know, I would bet that like everybody else, they're still using the old common rule, even though the federal government now says you can basically leave social scientists alone 90% of the time. And so if that's the case, then it's just yet another case of the rules being designed for hard science and not making sense for social science. I was at a meeting of the Faculty Senate a couple of weeks ago, and you know, we had our vice chancellor for research giving a presentation to the Faculty Senate here at UCLA. And you know, he was pointing out, and some of the people asked questions basically to the effect of, all the things that make sense for STEM don't make sense for social science. And he himself gave the example that early in one of their meetings, somebody was saying like, oh, our you know, Office for Research shouldn't even deal with, you know, small grants of less than $2 million, you know, or whatever the amount was. And then, you know, he pointed out that it's like, well, of course, $2 million is an enormous grant by social science standards. Even, you know, if you're in the kind of field where they build, you know, drug testing super colliders, that might be a small grant.
So I wonder if it's going to push research to secondary data analysis and sort of other exempt type of project designs.
Oh, if I was at USL, I would only do computer simulations.
Basically, right? You know, or like analyze GSS data. I would bet a policy like that will definitely influence the type of research that's pursued. And it might be a further, if this trend catches on, it's a further pressure on the more qualitative wings of our discipline.
Yeah. And I think to Gabriel's point too, you know, just about the shit flowing downhill, it's a model that works for the hard sciences, doesn't make sense for the social sciences, and is essentially unworkable for graduate students in the social sciences. Mm. Right? Like my dissertation project was not fundable. It was just not a fundable project. Like I, you know, graduate students should earmuff when I say this and never do this, but like I funded my dissertation research like out of my private bank account for my TA stipend. Right. So like $2,500 on an IRB proposal like would be the difference between me doing my dissertation or not.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know about you, about your departments, but our undergrads, like, they have to write a senior thesis. Mm-hmm. And as part of doing the senior, I mean, it's, they're empirical, so they have to go through IRB as well. I mean, undergrads are not going to pay $2,500 to do this. They really just aren't.
GSS regressions for everybody. For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.